Good morning. I'm Christopher Purdy. Delighted to welcome you to All Sides Books, our late summer edition with our panel today. Kevin Griffith, professor of English and creative writing and poetry at Capital University. Bill Eichenberger is a book blogger. His blog is thebooksurf.com. He has a little news for us we're going to get to in a moment. And Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic, The Adult, who brings a welcomed touch of class to the proceedings wherever she is. Thank you very much, Cassie Rose.
Thank you, Christopher.
What's your news, Bill Eichenberger?
I'll be teaching news writing at Capital University starting on Monday, August 30th, and also be the advisor for their student newspaper. So that should be a blast.
That should be a show, actually.
Yeah.
And whose fault is this?
Kevin's.
If you want a job, call Kevin Griffin.
Blame me. Yeah.
Congratulations and good for them.
Thank you.
That's going to be
I'm looking forward to it.
You all have a stack of books. We're going to talk about what you're reading now, what you're hearing about that's coming. We may invoke some past literary figures, and we will certainly welcome all the phone calls we can handle between now and 12 noon. I want to begin with a 50-year-old article that Cassie Rose just brought me off the web. Here's a luncheon. Where were you on February 5th, 1959? If you were in Nyack, New York, you could have had lunch with, get this, Carson McCullers, Marilyn Monroe, and Isaac Dinesen. What do you think they talked about, Cassie Rose?
Well, I think that they were gathering more because they were kindred spirits, because they were all rather broken, you could say, because they were struggling with health problems. I mean, Isaac was an anorexic and struggling with syphilis that she got from her husband that's in the Out of Africa book. Carson McCullers, by this point, had several strokes and was crippled. But she was, you know, a stellar literary personality. But Isaac was drawn to her, and so was Marilyn, because of her childhood and also the loneliness that she wrote about in her books. And Marilyn was there because she had also read, you know, Carson's books and was in awe of Isaac. And knowing their past and her own of struggling with either health problems or emotional issues, they were all very emotionally fragile, you could say.
The point I think bears mentioning that in 1959, Carson McCullers and Marilyn Monroe, who were both approaching the end of their lives, were young women.
Yeah.
They were women in their 30s. Carson might have been 40. She wasn't older.
She
than
was
that.
In her 40s, okay. Yes. And it was only a few years after that. After that lunch, Isaac went to the hospital and was diagnosed as malnourished and died shortly thereafter. I think that Marilyn, at that point of the lunch, she was married to Arthur Miller. And their marriage ended a couple years after that. And then it was soon after that, again, that she overdosed on the sleeping pills. And Carson, during that time also, she had another stroke is what happened. And so all of them died. Well, the two of them died young. But Isaac had as we all know from Out of Africa, had a very stellar and interesting life. But still underneath it was a lot of personal struggle and emotional struggle too.
I think they had physical and mental pain in common.
It'd be very much
so. As a thread between the three of them. I was thinking earlier that this idea would be a terrific play or book. I'm looking at three literary lights here. Let's chippity-chop. Let's go. I think it would be a wonderful stage presentation for something like that.
Absolutely it would, because it would bear some interpretation of how the lunch ended. Some people say, well, I think in Carson's autobiography, she says they were dancing on the table, the marble top table. At Carson's house. And Arthur Miller writes and says that couldn't have happened because she was too crippled and couldn't do it. So it bears some interpretation, too.
I think Arthur should just be quiet and let them dance. I think that's a wonderful image. I like it very much. Cassie, you and Kevin have brought the same book with you. I don't remember that happening before, and you were both very enthusiastic. So let's discuss Mentor by Tom Grimes. Who wants to go first?
I guess I can take that. Yeah, it's always wonderful when you see someone else with the same book you have. I always like that. That's a good validation that Cassie had the book as well. This is a fantastic book. It's a memoir by a writer, Tom Grimes, again. Tom Grimes now directs the creative writing program at Texas State University in southern Texas. But this is a story I think anybody who thinks they're going to try to write the great American novel should read this. It'll put things in perspective very quickly. It's a very almost tragic story of a Tom Grimes was working as a waiter in Florida. and he was desperately trying to get into graduate school to become a writer. Had applied to many programs, had didn't have much luck, but then suddenly Frank Conroy at the University of Iowa offered him a full tuition scholarship, and he became Frank Conroy's golden boy at Iowa in the Iowa Writers' Workshop in the early 80s. And he had so much promise and so much support there, and he had no trouble getting his novels published, but there was so much pressure upon him, and he was just, because he had success so quickly, he didn't really know how to handle it. And his work was ingenious. He was a great writer, but it met with mixed reviews, and he really couldn't handle that, nor could he handle a lot of the pressure from his peers and some of the mixed attitudes of the peers. Imagine if you went to a situation like that where everybody knows you're the chosen one, all the jealousies that emerged there. And I think – and it's really sad. I mean, he's doing great now. He's the director of a major program, and he just made the decision to, I'm going to focus my energies on education, on educating writers, not being one. And I looked up, it'll put things in perspective really quickly. I looked up his novels on Amazon.com, and you can get any of his novels for a penny used on Amazon.com. There, you know, there's your potential and greatness. And for every Jonathan Franzen out there, there's 100 Tom Grimes. People don't realize that. Yeah.
What was so hard for me is that his potential was, you know, just blazing when he went into the Iowa Writers' Workshop, because Frank Conroy had said he's writing this great baseball novel. So he'd walk down the hall and his peers would say, oh, so you're the baseball guy.
I want to make the point that the Iowa Writers' Workshop, that's about the Harvard for writing.
Yes,
that's the place. Yeah. That is the place to go.
Yes.
If you want to be a...
And he was rejected by the two other writer workshops. I mean, one of response that he got said that your novel excerpt is boring, and I give it a B- or something like that.
Yeah,
and then
great.
Here, Frank Conroy called him personally and said, wow, this is an astounding piece of work, and then got him into the workshop. And here he's writing this novel, and he is given the impression that he's going to be given six figures. He's going to have houses fighting over his novel. And what happens is he is given $40,000, and maybe there are five houses that are fighting for it, but he gets really confused because he doesn't understand. I mean, they're not fighting like they'd be fighting over Franzen, for example. And then when the book comes out, I mean, it sells maybe about 4,000 copies, and he doesn't earn back the $40,000, and he can't figure out, you know, why it is that he's been told by Frank Conroy, this is a beautiful novel, and, you know, a couple others are saying it, and I think Publishers Weekly panned it. I think maybe Kirkus gave it a starred review, which tells you how fickle this industry is, someone can love it and then another can pan it. And it really takes courage, and it takes a stable personality to be able to handle it.
I'm just wondering if, Father, you read the baseball book, because I love baseball books, and I'm going to go... Well, I'll report.
You'll
back.
Have to pay the penny to get it.
Yeah. Well, tell us what it is. Tell us.
No, I don't know. Okay. I haven't read it yet. That's what I was wondering.
Well, it's about that. His protagonist is a baseball player, and it's like he takes them through, you know, whatever his life. But and Frank Conroy got Tom Grimes set up to go and participate in the training camps of the New York Mets, and also talk to their managers in his research.
Frank Conroy was the author of The Great Santini, is that right? And Prince of Tides?
Pat Conroy.
Pat Conroy. Okay.
Frank Conroy is known for the memoir called Stop Time, and it's considered to be a masterpiece and a classic. And I wrote it after I read Mentor, instead of writing about Mentor on my blog, I wrote about Stop Time, because in reading Mentor, I realized that Stop Time was a masterpiece. And I had read Stop Time only a few years ago, and I didn't realize I was reading a masterpiece. So I wrote the blog post about, you know, going through that and saying, I probably need to reread that book.
Give us your blog address again.
It's thelongestchapter.com.
Okay, well worth it. You should bookmark that blog. Mentor is the book we're talking about. It's a memoir by Tom Grimes. Is it new? Is it a new?
Yes.
Christopher, it also raises another interesting issue, and that's that, and something that's sort of sad and dangerous about what the direction we're heading with writing is, the lack of a lot of different reviews. You see, if someone like Tom Grimes didn't have many places to be reviewed, then perhaps only the negative reviews would have been the ones that you would read. And you need this multiplicity of voices so that – because there's no such thing as a consensus. I mean, you know, you have to have a lot of different opinions and viewpoints to come up with, you know, to shape, you know, whether or not you'd be interested in reading a book.
And What's really interesting, I just was looking at the publicity. It's what's nice about this book as well. It's a great book, and it's from a small press, Tin House Books, so we should support them. And the book, the baseball book, was called Season's End, I see here. And that was another problem he had because it was immediately tagged as a baseball book, and he didn't want it. He wasn't necessarily a sports book. But speaking of reviews, it was really interesting. I had never heard of this before, but this is really depressing for a writer. It must have been devastating for him. But I think his third novel, the review in the New York Times was so bad that when they received it, they gave him the option of not printing it. Because it was so bad, and so it was never printed. And speaking of reviews, I had not heard that or knew that they do that.
Mm-hmm. I'm of the opinion, I still think there's no such thing as bad publicity. I'm of that opinion. I have a cynical frame of mind, but I'm just thinking there are reviews and then there's publicity. There are two. They sometimes intersect, but not often. And I think we have to – are we assuming that most readers read reviews? I mean, when we assign them this kind of importance, or are they going by buzz or word of mouth or like that?
Michael Connelly, the thriller writer, wrote an essay in the Los Angeles Times just about that, and he said he was a failure in most parts of the country. And then a critic in Atlanta at the Constitution there raved about his books. He became kind of a regional gangbusters in the South and in the Atlanta, Georgia area, and it was from there that it justified another book from the publisher, and he was able finally to cross over to the rest of the country. So I think they do read books, and that you can, if you champion someone as a reviewer, that it can make a difference.
It does make a difference if you're mentioned in the New York Times.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely, yeah. Whether it is good or bad. Because also to the point of like Bill's interest here in saying, oh, it's a baseball book, I'm going to read it. It doesn't matter that it's a negative review. If you're interested in the topic or the subject matter, you're still going to pick the book up and form your own opinion.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, of course, I know that baseball books, that's unfortunate, sort of a name to call them, because baseball books are rarely just about baseball. I love Mark Harris's Bang the Drum Slowly and his quartet of books, The Southpaws, the first one. And they're just wonderful, but they're not really about baseball. They're about life, you know. Mm-hmm.
Cassie Rose has in her stack a large book, a big, thick book, and I tend to like books with lots of pages. And Bill Eichenberger has brought us a book about Chicago we're going to talk about in just a moment. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend, and we are talking about books. We're together until 12 noon with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. And we will want to hear from you. We'll want your phone call, 614-292-8513. We're going to take a break now and be back in 1 minute. This is All Sides Weekend / books here on WOSU.
On your morning commute, get the stories behind the headlines with Morning Edition.
Save-A-Lot's parent company, SuperValue Incorporated, reports that coupons and food stamp usage continue to rise, indicating a turnaround in the economy has yet to arrive.
We have a very cautious consumer. They're making a list at home, and they're bringing that list to the store, and they're following that list.
Start your day with the award-winning WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
And this is All Sides Weekend on WOSU 820 NPR News. 81 degrees at 11:19 this morning, sunshine today and a high of 92, clear skies tonight and a low of 70.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer, a family-owned Midwest supercenter supporting the local economy by offering a variety of homegrown produce from Ohio and all the markets Meijer serves. More information is available at Meijer.com.
All Sides Weekend continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
We are back. I'm Christopher Purdy with Cassie Rose, Bill Eichenberger, and Kevin Griffith talking about books. Looking forward to your phone calls, 614-292-8513, or send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. Cassie Rose has a book called The Hunger Games, and she just gave me a very pithy précis about this, which I'd like her to repeat. You're pretty excited about this book.
I am excited about it, and it's a young adult book. It's a book written for children, and which is not generally a genre I go for. And again, I won't go into too much detail about it. I will just say I wrote about that experience on the blog, too, about opening up to reading young adult novels. The Hunger Games is the first book in a series, and the third book in the series is a big publishing phenomenon this summer, so big that no reviews were sent out to the critics. It's a secret release, all of that, and that which is called Mockingjay. But so back to the first book, The Hunger Games, which I just picked up. All I have to say is that oftentimes we say a book is engaging, we can't put it down or whatever. And I confess to Christopher that I seriously considered canceling not coming to the show so that I could sit and read this book because I can't – I look forward to reading it. And I can't – it's a type of excitement that is just – it's beyond description. And part of it, I think, has to do with it. It is a young adult novel. So there is this wonder, this newness, this discovery, again, which I write about in the longest chapter. And there was an essay a week ago in the New York Times about adults reading young adult novels. And
well, a lot of us read Harry Potter. I read all of them.
Right. And there are a lot of adults that are coming toward this novel, too. Now, the premise of it is grotesque, and I think people are put off by that. And I was at the beginning, too, when it was recommended to me, which is that there is a country that used to be North America, and there is a capital city, and it is surrounded by its districts. There are 12 districts. The 13th was destroyed in the rebellion of the districts against the capital. And in punishment to all the districts that lost, every year there is a reaping. And at this reaping, it is sort of like a lottery. And one boy and one girl from each district between the ages of 12 and 18 are chosen to go fight to the death in an arena. There is only one survivor.
And this is a kid's book.
And
Ray.
This is a kid's book. Ray. So, well, the thing is, that's it. And you think, how could this be? But because it is a young adult, what comes through is it's reading it with a kid's mind, it's authority. Here you have this authority telling you what to do, and you have to go and fight. And the fighters are all, you know, dressed and told how they are to behave, and they go through an interview. And in a kid's mind, it has got to be like reading about, you know, what your parents are telling you and what the schools are telling you. And you're able to and you're in defiance against that, which Katniss, who is the first-person narrator, I mean, she's a tough 16-year-old girl who knows how to go and hunt in the woods and stuff. So from a kid's viewpoint, it's much more palatable because there are different issues. As adults, I mean, we worry about the relationships and we worry about this whole horror side of it. You know, kids are in the frame of mind, which this article in the New York Times said was, you know, their biggest worry is who I'm going to sit next to at lunch. You know, and oh my God.
Who can I text? Yeah.
But, right.
But if that's true, then why the interest in dystopian stories like this? I mean, because I do think that teens are very interested in worlds turned upside down and in a sense that one of the things I got from these kind of things is that they want to sort of set the world right. Their world seems out of whack to them, and by reading these with the teens being the heroes and fixing the problems, they kind of it empowers them in a way. So I don't know if you know that. I mean, if that's kind of part of it too, though, that they the great world outside troubles them, but they can't express it, so they. That's turn to these kind of books.
Yeah, that absolutely fits. And I'm not I have not been a long-time reader of young adult novels, and in coming into this, I mean, your expression of that, that's a perfect fit for what is going on here.
We're talking about a book called The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. This is the first of a series, is that right?
Correct. And the second book is called Catching Fire. And the third book, Mockingjay, is I don't know whether it's released yet or not.
It's coming out this week,
is it the 24th?
I think. Yeah.
And it's one of those silent, nobody gets to see it ahead of time.
12:01 a.m. it comes out.
That's right. We have to go to the store and stand in line like we did for Harry Potter.
Yes.
Suzanne Collins, did she come out of nowhere with these books? Was she an established writer? Did you know her before these books were published?
I didn't know her, but again, she's in the genre that I don't typically read, and she had written books before.
Our phone number is 292-8513 with the 614 area code. You can send an email to allsides@wosu.org if you'd like to join the conversation about books. We have a call from Gabrielle, who I understand was recently a guest on this program. Gabrielle, good morning.
Hi. My mother, actually, named Gabrielle Burton, also was the writer of a couple of recent books, Impatient with Desire and Searching for Tamsin Donner. And I just wanted to echo what you were saying about the publishing business and how writers are expected now to really be the muscle behind their books because it's so random what they're reviewed in and who picks them up and And also the power of reviews. For instance, her her books were reviewed by Maureen Corrigan recently, and her Amazon rating went in a day from something near 400,000 to the top 10.
Wow.
And, that'll do it.
And, you know,
Maureen liked her, obviously.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah, it was a stellar review. And so, you know, I think that that's something where people don't often think about. I'm a filmmaker, and people don't, you know, they'll complain to me about the state of movies, and they don't realize the power that each person has as a consumer. And I think that that's something that we used to say to people, you're voting with your pocketbook. You know, you vote at the box office, you vote at the bookstore. And a major place to also vote is independent bookstores, you know, like the Beehive in Delaware, these
yep.
stores that really keep authors alive and keep diversity in the marketplace. So I think I just wanted to sort of put out a shout out for the authors doing their work and also for the bookstores behind them. Yep.
Thank you, Gabrielle, very much for your call. Thanks so much. Our number is 292-8513 if you'd like to join the conversation, talking about books, talking about the publishing industry, the phenomenon of these new young people books. And Bill Eichenberger just gave Cassie a thumbs up of a dog. I always have to look upside down, so bear with me, called My Dog Tulip. So I'll let Bill talk about My Dog Tulip a little
no,
bit.
No, I want to hear what Cassie has to say.
Well, I was going to say I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Compare notes. What's My Dog Tulip?
It's a classic book about a man and his dog, and it came out way before you know, all these dog books, you know, Me and Marley. And
I'd rather see the movie My Dog Tulip than Me and Marley, or,
yes,
or Marley and I, or whatever the heck it's
Marley
called.
Marley and Me.
Yes.
Thank you very much. And I thought it was very nice.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Well, they are coming out with an animated film with it. And so I saw some previews of it, and I thought I need to read this book because it is put out by the New York Review of Books Classics. And it's I mean, it's proper because it's written in the 1950s by a British literary scholar. So you get the word hitherto in there occasionally. But he lets his dog be a dog. He doesn't – is it the word anthropomorphize, that you make them human?
God, you people with your words today. I'm just trying to sit here for crying. Dystopia early. My goodness. Come on.
So it's – and he in letting her do that, she does all the things that most people would frown out. And, of course, this was a time also before people were picking up the poo in the streets with the bag. And he wants
that's
to find
dogs
her.
Were dogs. Yeah.
They
right,
were
right,
well,
yeah.
Wants to, and the whole mating routine that's going on. I mean, it's pretty. I don't know what
icky.
The word is.
Well,
it could be. Yes,
highly anthropomorphic. I mean, it's there's almost no difference between Ackley and the dog. You can't. I mean, it's. It says he assumes that the dog is an equal in terms of intellect and point of view.
That is true.
And so, I mean, it really
is. That is true.
Yeah,
so in that case, you're right. Yes, yeah. It is. It's like it's another person in the household.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's not a – but he doesn't have that emotional, you know, oh, sweetie pie
oh,
kind
no,
of a thing.
Huh?
It's
okay.
This is an intellectual person.
He's not talking him. Baby talk to an animal,
right.
Which is kind of obnoxious.
Yeah, exactly.
Kevin Griffith, you often use words I understand. So I'm going to ask you for to weigh in on something. You've got – you always bring
– Well, I thought we would
–
we were talking
here.
Christopher
yeah.
actually, right? Christopher, you talk about After the Workshop. Go
after,
ahead.
John McNally's After the Workshop – I'll talk a little bit about it. First of all, I read these things and love them, and a week later I forget them, which is terrible. Does that ever happen to the rest of you? So it's awful. I mean, but this guy is a handler. I think it's set in Iowa at the University of Iowa workshop, and his job is to take care of the visiting authors. Mm-hmm. And therein lies several tales. I mean, as you said, he had to buy a breast pump for one of them at 3 o'clock in the morning. One of them he lost. He couldn't – she took off. He couldn't find her. And there's a lot of – it's very, very funny.
Yes, it is.
Take it.
And we talked about the Tom Grimes book, which is a very serious, profound book about what happens when a writer realizes he's just not going to reach the heights he had envisioned for himself. In this one, it's like, what would happen if Tom Grimes had stayed in Iowa and really hit the skids and become a media handler, often for the people who went to school with him and now coming back as really big figures. John McNally is just a great writer. He's very funny. I strongly recommend
very
all of
funny.
His novels. The one he wrote before this is about the standardized test industry, which he also worked for. That's very funny as well. But it's great. He just skewers the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Really takes to task the sort of pompousness and self-indulgent nature of a lot of writers and what they demand when they come to come to campus. Yeah, and it's very funny. He talks about driving one of the writers from the airport in his Toyota Corolla, and the muffler falls off in the conversation, and he doesn't have enough money to put it back on. So all through the novel, there's, you know, people are holding their ears and screaming every time he drives by in his Corolla. And it's just fantastic, and it's a very funny novel, but it doesn't really have a happy ending. He ends up one of the most pompous writers at the workshop ends up marrying his former girlfriend at the end. It's very sad.
So it's a novel, but based on true stories, we would imagine.
Oh, yes.
I'm sure a number of people are sitting there in the margins writing in real names and saying yes. You know,
and the protagonist in this novel was also a golden boy, and his mentor is. Modeled after Frank Conroy as well. And, of course, this person, the protagonist in this novel, comes to the workshop, and immediately his short story is published in The New Yorker and the Best American
and
Fiction.
And
then
that's it.
Yeah. Then he does nothing
19.
After
that's
that.
It. That's yeah. it. Uh-huh. Yeah. And he has a neighbor across the hall who's a nudist in Iowa in February.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, that's like page 6, and it goes on.
Yeah. And a publicist comes in from New York City and finds the guy who can't – he's decided not to wear clothes.
Right.
He said, this would be a great book idea, and offers him a huge advance about the guy who, you know, he said, if you can go like 50 days without wearing clothes, and, you know, we'll write a memoir, I'll get you a 6-figure advance on that.
He's already gone 2 years. 292-8513 if you'd like to talk about books and use words I understand. I'd appreciate that. Allsides@wosu.org is our email. Cassie Rose, Bill Eichenberger, and Kevin Griffith are here. I wanted to ask you about the Chicago book you brought in, Bill.
Well, before we do that, I hate to – but because you had asked a question about reading and then not remembering the books and stuff. There was an essay in Harper's Magazine in the early 1990s where the writer was saying that he was reading this book and he was inspired by a passage and he ran to get his pen and he was going to underline the passage and he realized, oh, it had already been underlined. And he continues reading and this one's going to get a 5 stars in the margin because that is one he really – and of course, there's 5 stars. It goes on and on. Of course, he's read the book before and completely forgotten that he'd read it.
I'm glad I'm not the only one. But, I mean, after like 2 weeks, I have no – I mean, I saw the John McNally book in the library displayed and last week and I thought – I did take it down and thought, this looks good, and realized after 5 minutes that I'd read it and loved it. But I loved it that much, I couldn't remember.
So do you have to keep a list then of books
I do keep a list.
Okay.
I do keep a list, and every it's my ritual. Every New Year's Eve, I type my list of what I read this year, which is a little sick if you think about it, but
well,
sad
you probably
maybe,
need
but
it
that.
As a reference,
but
though,
I do
you?
That, yes, yeah. yes. So, yes, so stay away.
It's The Girls of Murder City. Subtitled Fame, Lust, and the Beautiful Killers Who Inspired Chicago.
You mean the musical, the Broadway show?
The Broadway show, Chicago. And it's by Douglas Perry, and it's a nonfiction. And it's really about not just the beautiful women. I love the opening line to the prologue. He says, the most beautiful women in the city were murderers. And it goes on from there.
That's a
hook line. But there were very – there's a young woman who comes to the big city, to Chicago – gets a job at a newspaper, and she's supposed to cover social activities and cooking and how to darn your socks or something. And instead she gets to cover these trials of two women who are being prosecuted for notorious murders. And it's all set in the 1920s and bootlegging and jazzy Chicago. And but it's the story of the reporter and how she came to cover these cases, and then the women and how they came to be murderers.
Was she what they called in the show a sob sister? They used to call them sob sisters.
That's
they wrote about these downtrodden, horrible killers, you know, who are out there. Yes. This is not fiction, then, is that
no,
correct?
No, okay. But it captures that sort of glamorous. I've just started it, so I'm not. I just wanted to ring it because I thought you'd get a kick out of it.
The Girls of Murder City, and I see the words Fame and Lust on the cover. I mean, what's the rest of the title?
The Beautiful Killers Who Inspired Chicago.
Very good. Yeah. And Cassie Rose, I wanted to ask actually the three of you, how do you decide what you're going to blog about in your books? Because you have – I mean, I can imagine the choices can be devastating.
Mine's easier because I blog about the books that I've read already and were fascinated by and loved and want to know more about the books, and so I talk to the authors.
Are they necessarily – they're not necessarily new books or are they generally –
not necessarily if I come across – well, or like in the case of the last blog item that I put up was an interview – or was going to be an interview. It's not up yet – of the Canadian author of The Trade that I talked about last time. But it was so fascinating and I wanted to know, you know, what he thought about, you know, the way Canadian history is taught and so on and so forth. And so that's how I decide. It's just things that I've read and then if I've been fascinated by it.
How about you, Cassie?
Because mine is about my journey with books, it's more of a real-time kind of experience. So when the ideas come to me, like, for example, here I'd read the book Mentor, and instead of writing about the book Mentor, I wrote about my experience of realizing that I didn't realize that Frank Conroy's Stop Time was a masterpiece.
And you go back to...
So I go back and so I revisit that. Or it may be that here I found out there was an award from graphic artists books or graphic design books, and one of the books on the list was a book that was handed to me when I left Chicago in 1987 by a very dear friend, and I went through that memory as well as writing about that book, which is Paul Rand's a graphic design book, and which is a classic. Mm-hmm. So it's more about almost day-to-day or week-to-week my experiences with new books, and I may go back and talk about a classic because it has hit my radar screen right away. Or maybe, you know, the Carson McCullers I wrote about was because it was a book that was sort of staring at me from my bookshelf, and so I put the picture up of that. So it's more real books and new books and real-time experiences.
And I realized I wanted to read Carson McCullers by reading your blog, so I thank you very much for
that.
TheLongestChapter.com, TheBookSurf.com. Kevin, how are you choosing what you teach? I know there's probably a lexicon, but you also probably have a little bit of room for...
Yes, that's good that you asked that. First of all, I would say I don't blog because I come here to talk about books. I have two great colleagues who write fantastic blogs that I consult all the time to get ideas. I had mentioned this author before. This is interesting because this is kind of an intersection of many things we've been talking about, people you forgot about, books you forgot about. But I had read this book about 10 years ago. In fact, this book came out in 1998 called The Extra Man by Jonathan Ames. And I use Jonathan Ames's books in my intro to creative writing classes because he's such a clever writer. He's famous for his nonfiction essays. He's kind of like David Sedaris with an even harder edge. But The Extra Man is a fantastic novel, and it's just been re-released because it's coming out as a movie this fall. That's fantastic when you see a novel that you enjoy but you thought had been, you know, remaindered or whatever coming back. And it's a great novel. Ames is a great writer. Like I said, he's a model of how to write very succinct, funny prose. And The Extra Man is a story of a very a 70-year-old man who has an apartment in New York City, and he puts a little ad out for a roommate, and so young 20-something writer comes and moves in with him, and it's kind of a classic odd couple premise, but it gets really dark because Lewis Ives, who's the 20-something, is also sexually ambiguous and experiments a lot with transvestism and hangs out a lot with transsexuals, and of course his roommate is a very uptight old gentleman who makes his living, this is very interesting, as an extra man. And what an extra man does is he gets a lot of associates who are very elderly women who just want someone to go to the opera with them or someone to go to dinner with them.
He's a walker.
There's nothing untoward about it, but
he
just goes and they pay him and he has a nice free dinners, free opera. And eventually he works Lewis Ives into his business, and it leads to a lot of conflict. It's great, though. The Extra Man by Jonathan Ames. And Ames is a great writer.
I'm going to read that book and see if I can get a job doing that. Jonathan Ames, The Extra Man. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Books with Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. We're back in 90 seconds to take your calls. Don't go away.
All our money, and then she tells me I'm too tired.
John Mellencamp's new CD, No Better Than This, was recorded on his days off while he was on the road with Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson. On the next Fresh Air, a musical retrospective with John Mellencamp. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Be sure to watch Columbus on the Record on WOSU TV. Each week, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson talks with political analysts and news reporters about the top stories of the week. And tonight on Columbus on the Record, they will discuss President Obama's visit to Ohio and get an update on Central Ohio congressional races and more. Columbus on the Record tonight at 8:30 on WOSU TV. And it is 83 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, a high of 92. Clear skies tonight and a low of 70 degrees. Sunshine expected for Saturday. There is a slight chance of rain, but a high of 92. Cloudy skies for Sunday and a better chance of rain and a high of 85. All Sides Weekend continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us and good morning.
Thank you, our producer, Amy Jurevich, who keeps us on the money here. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. We have several people on hold. Bruce has been holding for a while. I'm sorry, Bruce. Are you still there?
Hello.
Hello.
I'm calling about the book, The Hunger Project or something.
The Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games. Yeah, I think it's pretty irresponsible to be promoting a book like that to our young people where they're given a world that's totally devastated and their only empowerment is to try to murder a fellow victim. I'd like to see if folks find something where the young people's idealism is actualized and this madness is turned around and give them some hope.
Well, I can't speak to that because I'm only halfway through the book. So I have a feeling, though, it probably resolves in a way that would address that. I can't imagine that.
No, it's not. The battle is not glorified by the author.
It's
the whole premise, sir, is that the world, we're SOL. And I'd like to see something where we enact, take these criminals in hand, the banksters and the warmongers, and enact or, empower the enforce the laws that are on the books.
I think that is probably more of my take on it is that we're looking at it through then the eyes of an adult. There is an article in the New York – I've referenced it a couple times. It was in the New York Times, the essay page of the Sunday Review about a week ago. And it's about the young adult novels being filled with newness and discovery and wonder and taking chances. And it is in that kind of vein. It's not being criminal or murder or devastation, those negative viewpoints that we as adults have. So it's a whole different world and perspective.
I understand Bruce's point, though, and I'm glad you called, Bruce. Thank you. But I think also the purpose of a book like that for young people is to provoke debate and thought. Really, and to really look at, like, is this really the world we want? Is this – because, you know, how many chipper, cheerful, wide-open teenagers have you met in your life? I mean, it's, you know, it's a very rough time of life. And
sure.
I think it's necessary that sometimes that kind of angst is reflected back.
Absolutely. You have to – I mean, that's a cardinal rule as far as I'm concerned for writing for any younger audience is that you have to be honest. And the second you start lying to them, they know it and they get – or sugarcoating things. I mean, that's the absolute wrong way to go, I think.
And there is none of that is going on. But also for me as a reader, I don't like violence and you know, that kind of, you know, and I mean, I will read violent books and stuff like that, but I'm not getting that from this book. It is, yes, what I have said about it is violent, but I don't cringe reading the book. And like the violence we read in Matterhorn, you know, with that kind of thing.
There was a lot of redemption in that book, I think, the book
right.
about the Vietnam War that we talked about a few
right.
Yeah.
Right, but I didn't, you know, and I cringed reading
it. Visceral,
though, and it was very realistic. Mm-hmm. And I cringed reading that, but I certainly kept reading because it was very moving and realistic. But with this book, I'm not cringing or saying, oh, this is awful or whatever. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I don't know this genre well enough to be able to say, what is that then that makes it okay and palatable?
The fact that though, we're fostering this kind of discussion means the author's doing her job, I
think.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a great
more
thing.
More sales for Susan Collins.
Well, okay, moving on. We have a call from Siobhan about a book called Skylar's Monster. I hope I said your name correctly. Thank you for holding.
Yep, this is Siobhan.
Hi.
Hi. I read a book by a blogging dad about his daughter with – she has a brain deformity, and it was about discovering what was the matter with her. She didn't speak, and he continues to blog about her, and this is just the most poignant book. I didn't know if you'd heard about it. I think it's – I can't remember who published it. It's a small press maybe. He's from Texas, but I thought people ought to know. It's just an amazing story of this father's fight to – help his daughter find words because her brain deformity allows her not to be able to use her facial muscles in order to speak.
The book is called Skylar's Monster?
Yeah, and it's spelled the Dutch way, so it's S-C-H-U-Y.
U-Y-L-E-R, right.
Skylar's Monster. And the author is Robert Rummel Hudson.
Okay.
And his blog is Fighting Monsters with Rubber Swords. It's awesome. He's still blogging, and it's just it's amazing. But I thought people might want to know about it. It's just a really touching, tender, bad daughter book, which there aren't often a lot of.
Siobhan, thank you so much for that call. We appreciate it. Thank you very much. We have a call from Carol, who likes to read to feel good. I don't blame her. Carol, hello, you there?
Oh, hi. Thanks.
Hi.
You know, I'm a voracious reader. I probably have 30 books right now from the wonderful Columbus Library System, you know, and... But a lot of the books you talk about, and I get the New York Times every Sunday just so I can have the book review. And, of course, it's become smaller and smaller over the years. And but, you know, a lot of the people on the street, I don't know. I mean, I don't read for what's on the New York Times bestseller list. I read what it's about, and I don't want things that are going to depress me. And it seems a lot of the current fiction, you know, I love a good mystery, and I love some good fantasies, and one of my favorite authors, and I never hear people talk about it because she mostly writes in maybe a scientific, sci-fi genre, is Connie Willis, and she came out with her book called The Black Blackout in March, and it's kind of it's a series, it has several other books in along the way, but this one is, there's time travel involved. It's 2050, and they're out of England. And what I like about it is it's an interesting story because she did a ton of research. She went to England, and she studied the Blitz. It's all about the London Blitz. That's why it's called Blackout. But you never talk about things like this, which are popular fiction, because it just seems like, you know, this new series that come out, these Erman Shaman books like Kim Harrison and the Dead Witch Walking series. These are books that people on the street are reading, and I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about them, because I'm always looking for new authors and stuff like that. And
well, I'm glad you called, because we didn't know a lot of this stuff, and I've been writing down your titles as you've been giving them.
Connie Willis is a wonderful author, and this series is kind of funny. Some of the books can be very funny. She did a book called The Doomsday Book about 15 years ago. About this, they're graduate students, and they go back in time, but it's very scientifically done. They don't spend a lot of time dwelling on it, but they study up on the era they're going back to, and they compare what life, she does research, and you know what living in the time of the bubonic plague would be like when you read this Doomsday book, and how the poorest cloth you can make in the 21st century looks like incredible riches to these people back then. And to me, that is fascinating, because you're learning history by the author who has done this incredible research. She is just a wonderful author, and I brought this book Blackout in, and she was originally going to do one book, and she had so much information, and it's really interesting about the Blitz, because these people go back there, and they know what subway was bombed one day, and they try to avoid it, because they have to go in the subways when they were bombing this. It's wonderful.
But this sounds to be, you said that you liked books that are uplifting.
So. Well, it is uplifting because, everything's going to probably, you know, come out in the end, but you're learning a lot about history at the same time you're involved in a mystery.
So there's a distance there between, probably because it's historical?
It is, but as I said, there are some really, you know, I love a good British mystery. I mean, there are some wonderful British authors, Elizabeth George and things like this.
You'd like my wife. She's exactly the same as you.
And I am constantly reading, and I did read the book The Help, which Kathleen Stockard, like that. Only because I have some background with the Deep South. My father is from there. But I thought it was very simply written. But, you know, it was a different way of approaching a subject that, you know. But I think some of the books you guys talk about, I am never going to pick up in a million years, because I want a story. I want a really good story.
Okay. Carol, we appreciate the call. I've got to move on. But thank you very much for your calling. I appreciate that. We have an email that I just lost, so we're going to talk to Kelly now. She had a response to Bruce's call from earlier. We need to keep the calls a little bit brief because we've got a lot of them on hold, and we only have a few more minutes left. Go ahead, Kelly. Are you there? Okay, I guess not there. All right. Priscilla, are you there? Well, my goodness. Okay. Oh, well, how about Nancy has a book about Scotland. Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I am here. The previous caller was talking about interesting stories and bringing in some history. I travel quite a bit for fun, and I always like to find books to read about the places I've traveled. And Ian Rankin and his crime scene, they're not murder mysteries, they're just crime stories about Scotland, I have found to be very interesting because he brings in a lot of contemporary problems that are facing Scotland. And I've been in Scotland twice in the past 2 or 3 years, and I just found that very interesting reading. Also, he really uses real places, real bars, real restaurants, real streets. And if you have a good map of Scotland, you can follow him as he goes. The streetwise ones are the best ones. There is one I have not read. In fact, I couldn't find it. I think it's called The Death at the Venice, the opera house.
Oh, in Venice, yeah.
In Venice. Yeah. It was written by an American woman.
Right. She has a whole series of Italian operatic murder mysteries,
yes.
I think. Yeah.
Yes. Do you remember her name?
I don't, and I remembered liking two of the books that I read. You know, there you go. I forgot. Yes.
And then also, when I was in Bangkok, I read John Burnett's Tattoo. Which is just really a crazy, crazy book. And then also Jason Goodwin has written a series of not quite crime, but strange things happening about Istanbul and Turkey. The one I read was The Janissary Tree.
Ah.
So I think that this is a variety of books that for people who do some traveling that are quite interesting. Bedside reading before you go, while you're there, and after you come back.
Nancy, we thank you so much for the recommendations.
You're welcome.
And Priscilla and Kelly, who are on hold, it was me who hit the wrong button. My apologies. And we have Priscilla, I hope, now. Priscilla, are you there?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking my
sure.
call. I just wanted to recommend a book I've recently read called The Book Thief. And I got it on the Sony Reader at the Upper Arlington Library.
Marcus Zusak, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I went to look for it, and I found it's in the young adult section,
yep.
which I thought was very mm-hmm. interesting. And I remember I liked Holes, which, of course, is in the young adult mm-hmm. section.
That's
so
nice.
I think that's...
I'm getting all nods from the panel when you just said that, Priscilla.
So anyway, I just wanted to recommend that book. It was about a young woman, a girl in Germany who was adopted by a foster family, and what it was like during the Second World War and her life and the people, you know, who interacted with her.
This she loves, and she loves books. That's
yes,
the book
she loves
thief.
Books.
Yes.
Yeah, that's why she's the book thief.
The book thief and the author again is?
Marcus Zusak, Z-U-S-A-K.
Zusak, The Book Thief, Marcus Zusak. Priscilla, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate that.
Yep.
We have an email. There's another young adult memoir written by a local author who resides in Columbus called Good Behavior by Nathan L. Henry. He's featured in this month's 614 magazine. He's been getting some good reviews regionally. That's good to know. I always like to hear about authors who are publishing who actually could walk to WOSU or you see in the supermarket or in the library. Again, the book's title, Good Behavior by Nathan L. Henry. And we have Kelly on the line who had a response to an earlier call. Kelly, hi, are you there?
Yes. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I totally understand the point of view of wanting children to maybe kind of read something that's a little bit escapist and it be uplifting. Right now, we're going through a lot of things domestically, internationally, and kids aren't stupid. They know what's going on in the world, too. But it reminds me of a class I took in college where we read a really, really depressing book called Miss Lonely Hearts by Nathaniel West.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in that same class, we also read a Flannery O'Connor book, also not really very uplifting. And our instructor at one point, because somebody was complaining how depressing all the books were, our instructor said, look, you know, you don't want to go through life walking around like unopened loaves of Kroger white bread. and that has always stuck mm-hmm. with me. So mm-hmm. I think that in order to always enjoy the beauty in life, sometimes you have to look at
amen.
The yeah, other side.
Exactly
the other
right.
side. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks so much, Kelly. I think that one of the purposes of a book is to make you think, even if it's mm-hmm. You know, something that's on the lighter side.
Yeah, from a writer's standpoint, you know, I get that all the time. Why are you making us read stuff that's so depressing? And I just, you know, I remember Flaubert said, you know, every happy family is happy in the same way, and every unhappy family is unhappy in its own unique way.
Yes.
And from, you know, an, you know, we talk about, well, we got to have happy endings or whatever. Something has to be uplifting. You got all writing depends upon conflict to drive it. You have to have conflict for something to happen in a story. And finally, I, you know, often I, they'll say, you know, I don't, I want to read something that's uplifting. I say, well, I bet, you know, like what, like Chicken Soup for the Soul. Say, oh, yeah. And I said, well, what kind of people need chicken soup?
Sick people.
I said, so, yeah, you know, you have a healthy soul if you can read dark work and think. And
there you go.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and I think we got unfairly tagged today. We brought in a lot of really funny stuff. Uplifting Jonathan Ames, very funny. After the workshop, really, really funny.
Well, we have 3 minutes left, so each of you gets each of you gets a turn with a final say, a final recommendation, or a final push. And if you want to be funny, great. If you want to be depressing, terrific. Go for it. Let's start back with you, Kevin. Go ahead.
Well, I'll just really quickly, I'll just push The Extra Man by Jonathan Ames again. I was very impressed when it first came out in 1998. And if you haven't read Jonathan Ames, you should, and this is a good place to start.
Cassie Rose.
I'm going to push again a book that I mentioned in last month's show. It's The Personal History of Rachel Dupree by Anne Weisgarber, and it is on podcast on WSU.org/podcast. It's a terrific book that has a Willa Cather kind of an atmosphere, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and the twist on it is it's about an African-American family pioneering in the Badlands. And how it's all that they go through, and in a drought, and their own personal struggles, but also how they do not, during this time, it's 1917, they don't have to deal with discrimination because the equalizer at this time and in that terrain is surviving and owning land. They own 2,500 acres, and so its color is not an issue. So it's a very it's a beautiful book. It's also an involving book.
Give us the title one more time so we know.
It's The Personal History of Rachel Dupree.
And Bill Eichenberger has a book called A Call from Jersey, and I looked at that and thought, oh, my God, Jersey Shore. I just got so – Kevin doesn't know what that is. But anyway, Bill, you get the last word, Bill Eichenberger.
Okay. Well, I'll switch. I was going to talk about The Pirate Devlin because that's a swashbuckling pirate book, and that's very good. It's by Mark Keating. But A Call from Jersey is a novel by P.F. Kluge. He wrote a wonderful book about reading and writing the last time out. He's up at Kenyon as the visiting writer.
He wrote a book about Kenyon, too, that was fascinating.
Yes.
And fun, yeah.
But this book is A Call from Jersey, and it's the German-American experience starting the narrative's brother comes in 1925, and he follows him shortly thereafter in 1928. And he talks about – and it starts with landing at – well, not at Ellis Island, but in New York City. And Max Schmeling is at the top of the world and all that kind of stuff. And it just – it talks about an interesting – and it's just – he's a lively narrator, just really funny and the prose just absolutely moves. And he's just a wonderful raconteur as he recalls these German communities and the manicures and all that kind of thing and the dancing and kind of how they became who they were.
And as we wind up, Bill, give us your blog site one more time.
It's thebooksurf.com.
And you are starting
at blogspot.com.
At blogspot.com, and you're starting at Capital
The 30th of August.
And you're going to be advising the student newspaper as well,
yes.
Right? So maybe I can write the Lonely
Hearts
column.
Read Chimes.
Read Chimes. All right, great. And Cassie Rose, tell us your blog one more time.
It's thelongestchapter.com.
And Kevin Griffith, what's up for you in the new academic year? What's the first thing you're going to teach when you walk in?
Well, I was just going to remind people real quickly, Michael Andonche will be at Capitol, and I'll get further details later, but he'll be there in October.
Our next time together is September 17th. Write this down. This is All Sides Weekend / Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. Thank you to Bill Eichenberger, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.